Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Robert Scott. He is the associate director of the Advanced Study for Behavioral Sciences at Stanford. He's a professor at Princeton. He is the author of two books, The Gothic Enterprise, All About the Cathedrals in Europe, and his new book, Miracle Cures, which he will be speaking about today. It's a fascinating topic. I won't say more about it except for one thing. I read a very interesting study that was talking about testing a medical product, testing a medical drug. I'm sure it was a drug. And it showed that there were, the placebo did 7%, had 7% failure rate, and the drug had an 8% failure rate. And what was, so there was only a 1% difference. But what was most interesting to me was the fact that the side effects, cramped stomach, sort of the usual side effects of drugs, the placebo had 6% bad side effects. And people don't realize that. It certainly shows that something is going on between the mind and the body that we don't completely understand yet. We'll probably understand in 200 years, but let's start working on it. Dr. Scott.
Thank you for that introduction. I'm really pleased to be here. My wife, Julia, who is here in the audience, and I have been members of Commonwealth Club since we moved to San Francisco about 10 years ago. We've been to many occasions, have benefited and learned a great deal from all of them, and so you can imagine how intimidated I feel now being on what I consider to be the wrong side of the lectern. So we will see. We will see how this goes. Now, what I want to do is to start out by telling you how I got involved in this topic. I am a sociologist by training. Nothing in my training even remotely prepared me either for writing about Gothic cathedrals or about the topic I'm on right now. I kind of backed into them simply because I fell in love with Gothic cathedrals, and the topic took over my life. I wrote a book about them, which is about Gothic cathedral building in medieval Europe from about the 12th through the 15th century. And in the course of studying that topic, one of the things I wondered about is where did the money come from? And that is a very important question, because when you undertake to construct something like a Chartres Cathedral or a Canterbury like that, okay, that is a very expensive undertaking. These cathedrals and great abbey churches were kind of sinkholes for liquid capital at a time when liquid capital was very, very scarce. So that got me wondering, so where did it come from? And I won't go into the details of that, except one source of income that really got me wondering. And it came from the fact that pilgrims were frequently attracted to come to these cathedrals and great abbey churches in order to venerate saints whose remains were buried in these structures. And the practice of the day was for them to leave gifts, to gift the saint. Of course, what the shrine keepers were doing was receiving those gifts on behalf of the saint, kind of scooping them up, and then passing them along into the treasury, and they would make their way into the building department, and that was helping to underwrite the immense costs. It never was enough by any means to pay for the entire construction, but it was a very valuable and important source of revenue at the time. Now, I'm sure you all know about Becket's Shrine at Canterbury, Thomas Becket, the martyred archbishop, whose shrine became a very popular place in the late 12th and early 13th centuries. And it is, of course, what Canterbury Tales is about. What you may not appreciate is the volume of people who were attracted to pilgrimage at Canterbury. It was not unusual on important dates that marked the, well, it wasn't really quite the date of his martyrdom. He was martyred on December 29th of 1170, but they marked the occasion in early summer because the weather was better, and that meant it was easier for pilgrims to come. But it was not unusual for crowds of 100,000 and more to come to these events, and this at a time when the population of England and Wales combined was only about 4 million. So you get some idea of what an enormous magnet this would have been. And it generated very substantial amounts of money for Canterbury for various construction campaigns that were going on. So, for example, in 1220, which was the year after the great shrine to Becket was dedicated in the eastern end of the cathedral, the crowds were so large that two-thirds of the entire revenue that was available to the monastic order occupying the church or the cathedral at that time, two-thirds of the revenues came from gifts that were left by pilgrims. In average years, it was not unusual for these gifts to be in the order of about anywhere from 300 to 700 pounds in the currency of the day. Well, if you made a translation, that would really amount to something in the order of $9 to $18 million in modern currency. So it's a very substantial amount. So then the question is, so what was drawing these crowds? Well, they came for all sorts of reasons, but the one I got very interested in was people who were coming there who were suffering from illnesses of various kinds, who were seeking to receive miracle cures that they hoped would be facilitated through the intervention of the saint. And these miracle cures were absolutely vital to establishing what you might think of as the bona fides of a medieval place of pilgrimage. Now, why was that? Why was it so important? Well, there's the obvious reason that that people are going to be attracted there if word gets out that by going and venerating Becket, it will benefit your health. And there are propagandists, you know, who basically went out from the cathedral making sure that people around and about in the countryside had heard about this and other people who were sick would come. So that's clear. But for the cathedral itself, these reports of miracle cures were absolutely, they were gold to them. And here's why. It had to do with how people understood miracles happened at that time. And the idea was basically this, that all miracles basically emanated ultimately from God. It was only God who was able to grant a miracle. You and I, as ordinary mortals, would be foolish to make a direct plea to God for a miracle cure. That would be seen as presumptuous, something somehow unseemly. And beyond that, it was bound to fail because God had other things on her mind was an angry, portrayed as a kind of angry, brooding force who was quick to anger. And if you said the wrong thing or approached God in the wrong way, instead of getting a miracle, you might get whacked down. And so it was not thought to be a wise thing to do that. However, saints were different. And saints were different because they had lived lives of Christian virtue on behalf of God's cause. And so when they died, they were awarded a special favor in heaven. So the idea was that what you needed to do to get a miracle was to curry favor with a saint. And if the saint heard your appeal, and was so inclined, would then go to God and ask for a miracle, not because you had any, not because you deserved it, but rather because God was obligated to the saint for what he or she had done in the course of their life. Okay? So that's what the logic was. So what that meant is that if miracles were then being reported at these places of pilgrimage, that was seen as irrefutable evidence of the high standing of the saint within the kingdom of heaven. They had God's ear. That was the basic idea. And so in terms of establishing the bona fides of the cathedral, of the healing shrine, these miracle cures were kind of the gold currency that was just regarded as proof positive that the saint had very high standing in heaven. Now, there was another reason it was so important. Saints are very, as they were imagined in the medieval period, they're very interesting constructions. They are, so to speak, hybrid figures. The idea is basically that when they die, they, of course, ascend directly to heaven where they sit at the foot of God, but they also retain a presence here in this world. So they're present simultaneously in this world and the next. So if people thought that they were present in this world, then the question is, so where are they exactly? And the question then became, how do you know where to go if you want to ask a favor in the form of a miracle cure for a saint to intercede on your behalf to go there? And if miracle cures are happening at the place where their tomb is, that is considered to be their earthly home. And so it means that if you want to use Becket as your instrument, you've got to go to his earthly home, and it's at Canterbury, and it's right at his tomb. So for these reasons, these miracle cures were vitally important to kind of the survival and the popularization of these shrines. And so now I get to my question. The question that puzzled me is this. I told you that 100,000 and more, crowds of 100,000 and more could be drawn to these shrines. Many of the people going there were looking for miracle cures. And my question is, whatever led them to believe that by going to the tomb of a saint and venerating that saint, it could have any health benefit of any kind? Why did they think that? And to make that question even sharper, in most of these shrines, what they were actually doing is not going so much to the saint's tomb, but to reliquaries that were housing these odd bits of pieces that were associated with the saint at the time of his or her life. So they'd have a tooth, or they'd have a finger, or a bone from some other part of the body, or a piece of flesh, or a thread, or a strand of hair. And I'm sure any of you who have been in and around Europe and seen these reliquaries know the kind of the array of things. So the question is, whatever led them to think that by going and venerating a strand of hair, that this could have anything at all to do with improving their health? That was the question that I wondered about. Now, as I always do in these matters, since I'm not a medievalist by training, I turn to my medievalist colleagues and say, how do they answer this? What do they think the answer is? Well, you get basically two or three answers. One is, people believed it because that's what they had been taught. Fair enough. That's right. They had been taught that, and they certainly believed it. Whether that's a complete answer is another matter. Others say, look, you're dealing with ignorant, superstitious peasants. 90% of the people going there, you know, they're not educated, and they'll believe anything. And so that's why they believe it. And it's true that they were peasants and they were poorly educated. So, yeah, there's probably something to that. And then others will say, look, it's obvious what's going on here. What's going on is that people, it was the process of going on pilgrimage, which had effects like changes in diet, enriched diets, more varied diets than they were eating at the, you know, during the winter months in their hovels. These many of their illnesses were caused by dietary deficiencies, so you change the diet and they're going to get better. Or most of the illnesses that they had were self-limiting. So they're sick and they say, I'm going to go to Beckett and appeal to Beckett, and they do that. And the self-limiting nature of the illness works its way so that by the time they get to the shrine, they're really feeling pretty good. And Beckett gets the credit for it. And it, you know, if there had been what people in my business call a control group, the ones who stayed at home would have done just as well. That's what the argument is. Now, there's something to each of those things. I'm not dismissing them. But there's something that pains me about this kind of explanation. And what it is that you're talking about an institution that survived for 1,000 years. The medieval cult of saints was a robust activity in which tens of thousands of people participated. And I find it hard to believe that it's possible to sustain an institution with that much vibrancy on the basis of ignorance or misattribution of cause or a kind of blind adherence to belief. I think those are part of the explanation ultimately I tried to develop. But it seemed to me, you know, there's something missing here. There's got to be more to it than that. Now, George mentioned that in my previous life I used to teach at Princeton, and I taught sociology, and one of the courses that I loved to teach was on sort of the social psychology of health and illness. And what that was about is basically reviewing with students what's known about the role of culture, of belief, of immediate social circumstance, of emotions, of cognitions, of a whole array of psychological variables in accounting for the onset and the course and the outcome of illness. And as I thought about, as I read these accounts and got more and more puzzled by why people were so convinced that this practice worked, I began to realize what's missing in all of this is exactly the kind of thing that I used to teach when I was at Princeton and still occasionally do down at Stanford. And so that led me to say, okay, so let's take what that body of research tells us about the role of culture, of belief, of immediate social circumstance, of social support, of stress. I mean, all that, for those of you who know the popular literature about health and illness, these will all be familiar things. But let's take that and apply it to what we know about the practice of going on pilgrimage and appealing to saints, and see what kind of a story we get out of that. Does it add anything to the accounts that I've summarized or not? And so that's what my book is about. It's really an attempt to capture the insights growing out of this kind of this body of research and applying it to what I've been able to learn about the beliefs surrounding the practice of going on pilgrimage and venerating saints, to see what sense it might make out of it. So sort of a product disclosure, I'm not a medievalist, nor do I consider myself to be an authority on social and behavioral science research on this topic. And here I am trying to anneal these two things and inviting criticisms from all sides, and God knows I get them. The sense in which I offer this is really a kind of speculative hypothesis about that I think myself begins to make sense out of it. And the argument to get to the bottom line is that I think that when you actually look at it, there are very sound reasons for believing that there were genuine health benefits that accrued to people with certain kinds of illnesses when they undertook these pilgrimages and appealed to saints. Now, I can't lay out the whole argument here for you, so I'm not going to try to do that, but I will take sort of two veins of research that I've tried to mine so that at least you'll get some idea of how I've worked my way into that, developing that hypothesis. The two that I want to select actually are unified by a single thing, and that has to do with the critical role of belief and what contemporary social and behavioral science and biomedical science knows about the role that belief can play in the illness experience. Now, the first vein of work some of you may be familiar with. If you read the literature of psychology, you would find it under terms like framing or symptom perception. And what that's about is basically saying that the process of illness, of the illness experience and of becoming well again, is not one that is in any sense mechanical or automatic. It is very susceptible to belief, to expectations, to selective perception, and the like, so that symptom perception, evaluation, how we respond to it, how we decide that our response is actually helping, all those kinds of things are very, very problematic and uncertain for the majority of illnesses. It's not true of extreme illnesses, obviously. If you hit your hand with a hammer, perception happens pretty quickly, and it's pretty direct. But this has turned out to be a very important and fruitful area of study, which is explaining how people who, it turns out, can be having the same identical body sensations and symptoms are attending to them in radically different ways. Let me give you just one example so you get a flavor for what this work is about. There is a very well-known sociologist named David Mechanic, who some years ago did a wonderful study of where he followed medical students through the years of their medical education. And one of the things he found is that when they were first-year medical students, they had come out of undergraduate school studying, you know, calculus and chemistry and so on. And then they got to medical school, and a lot of their time was being spent learning the taxonomy of illness. They were learning about illnesses they never had heard of before, and they were being told, these are the illnesses, these are the symptoms, this is how you would know that somebody had them, this is the prognosis, this is how you treat it, and so on. And they were being kind of hammered by this. And what he found in the first year is that 70% of the students were absolutely certain that they had one or more of the illnesses about which they were learning. Right? It turned out 0% actually did, but they were absolutely certain. So what was going on is that they were monitoring bodily sensations as they went through the process of learning about these diseases and making these kind of connections, saying, oh, I see how this could be, and I have a fatal illness, and they would go to their professors and say, you know, how much time do I have? Well, it turns out that is such a well-documented thing in throughout medical education that it is known, it has a name, it's called medical student syndrome. But it gives you an illustration of what it is I'm talking about. Now, for our purposes, there's an equally important set of findings, because what I've talked about is how you decide, how you kind of arrive at the view, you start attending to bodily symptoms and then trying to put them together, make sense out of them, engage in some kind of self-diagnosis that leads you to say, maybe I should go see a doctor, and how do you know and or whatever you think is the appropriate way to respond. But the research is also showing that the very same process operates going the other way, and that is the same selectivity is operating when people come to arrive at a sense that, you know, I think I'm getting over this, I think I'm getting better. So it's not just becoming ill, but becoming well. And you'll see why that's so important in a minute. Okay, so that's what that, in a very sketchy way, is what that line of research is about. So what was going on in the medieval period that might feed into these kinds of calculations that people would be making, these kinds of perceptions that they would have? Well, at the time, notions of illness and what caused them were, of course, powerfully influenced by religious thought at the time. And it meant that if you became ill, not only would you have physical symptoms, but you were confronted with what could be momentous moral and ethical challenges and dilemmas that arose out of the fact that you had become ill. Why was that? Because people said the reason you became ill, people thought this of themselves, is because they had sinned, and they were being punished by an angry God. And it was seen as prima facie evidence of their having angered God. So if you ask people, you know, your neighbor is sick, what happened? They would cite things like this, that they had worked on a Sabbath. They had blasphemed a saint. They had blasphemed some important church doctrine. They violated a basic commandment. They cheated a neighbor. They conceived a child on the eve of a religious holiday. I mean, the list went on and on and on. But the idea was basically you did something that really angered God. And because of that, God is punishing you. And that's what your illness means. Now, that means that what you are adding on top of the physical discomfort of whatever your condition happens to be, compounding problems of stigma, of ostracism, of social denigration, your public reputation is jeopardized by the fact that you're ill. Now, compounding this is another problem, and that problem comes from a different line of thinking at the time. And it is that if you became ill, it wasn't just that you jeopardized yourself, you could be putting your entire community in jeopardy. And the reasoning that was behind that was as follows. What it had to do with is common communal beliefs about dependable sources of protection against chaos and harm and violence and invasion and drought and all the other calamitous things that characterize life during this period. It's not that we are immune from these, but we are encased in a cocoon of social institutions that are primed to respond, and when they respond, they can actually be helpful. So if a fire breaks out, a fire department can actually, there is one there, and it can respond and it can help. And a police department and a National Guard and health and sanitation workers, I mean, it goes on and on and on. So we are encased in a society with social institutions where there is a point to having what we familiarly know as a 911 number. You dial it and things happen and those things can actually help. In the medieval period, if there had been telephones and you could hook it up to dial 911, it would have been pointless. There was no help to be summoned. So the institutions could not be relied on. Well, what was relied on in its place was the belief that communities could reliably depend upon the protection of the divine to protect them from harm and from danger and from chaos and perdition. But to do that, what a community had to do was, A, gain God's attention, starting there, and then venerate God in such a way that he, she would extend protection to the community. And that's, in fact, what monastic orders were doing. That's what cathedral chapters were doing. They were praying on behalf of the community as a way of ensuring a benevolent relationship between the community and God. So if somebody became sick, and they got, and the line was that they became sick because they had angered God, this could jeopardize the entire community's protection. So it further stigmatized and it made a communal issue out of an individual case of illness. Now, when you think about that, you say, well, okay, now let's think about how that line of belief now impacts on what a miracle cure meant. Well, what a miracle cure meant is that God would not have given you a favor if he, she had not forgiven you for your illness, for your sin. So you could, if you came, left a community ill and came at back well, that opened the way to reintegrate you into the community. It removed the danger to the community of whatever your sin had been. And it made it possible, as a kind of a cultural practice, it made it possible for people to become reintegrated back into the community. Now, one additional point about that. I think you can get the drift of why this work on symptom perception kind of caught my attention. But there's one other element to it, and that is, you know, so why don't you just stay in the community? Why go on pilgrimage? Why don't you just stay in the community and try to deal with whatever you're having to deal with? Well, the answer is that the vast majority of people at the time were living in these small, isolated, remote agricultural villages where, if you could think about a social economy for those villages, it was organized around gossip and rumor. And actually, one of the major sources of gossip of all people turned out to be the parish priest to whom you should be turning to confess, because as he heard things about you and what you thought you had done, he'd quietly spread the word, and that would enhance his standing in the community. So it wasn't a very good resource. And all I'm trying to say is that it would be very difficult to imagine how you could handle this problem and still remain in the community and restore your good reputation. And pilgrimage becomes a cultural resource that's readily available to you. It's legitimated. You are addressing the root cause of your illness by confessing your sins and going to the saint and pleading for forgiveness and asking for a miracle. But at the same time, it's getting you, so to speak, out of Dodge. It's getting you out of town where you can be away for a while, and it allows you to kind of restore your social equilibrium within the community. Well, I think you can see how that whole kind of belief structure would now have its impact on the way in which people become sensitive, particularly sensitive to signs that this is working and that I am actually feeling better and paying attention to bodily symptoms that are indicative of being on the road to recovery, because that indicates that the saint has looked at you benevolently and it opens the way for recovery. Now, obviously, it's not going to apply to all forms of illness. I understand that. But I think you can see that it has a likely bearing on the way in which people are kind of experiencing their illness and experiencing their recoveries. Now, I'm going to leave that here. I'll happily answer questions about it when we get to that part. But let me now turn to a different part of belief. Because in matters of miracles, nothing is more fundamental to the practice of appealing to saints than the conviction that saints can actually cure you. They can actually, they can't cure you, but they can facilitate your cure. Well, as George in his introductory remarks pointed out, that's starting to sound like a whole line of research that's now getting quite a bit of play called placebo research. That's what placebo is about. And what I want to try to do is explain to you the part of that research that I think really speaks to what's going on here and helps us to understand what might be going on and adds credence to the idea that that the vibrancy of these beliefs would be plausible, I think, to argue would result in relief from distress. Now, the idea, as I'm sure you know, with placebo research is that what you do is basically administer what are called sham treatments, inert substances to people, in a way that's pervasive enough or persuasive enough for them to believe that what it is you are giving them is going to produce some relief from whatever their symptoms might happen to be. And they then try to see whether sugar pills or innocuous inert ointments and so on can make any difference. And this is sometimes now referred to as the meaning response or the expectancy effects or the mind-body problem. I mean, it comes under various headings. Now, some of the research that's been done here is really pretty interesting. This is not an esoteric and minor effect. It's a pretty substantial effect. Let me just summarize for you some of the findings. If I give you a placebo and I say to you, you need to take this pill, take four pills three times a day and take four again at bedtime, and they're sugar pills, you will get a more robust response than if I say, just take one in the morning and one at night. So the more of the apparent medication you're giving, the bigger, the more robust the placebo effect. If it turns out that, let's say, I'm trying to convince you that what I'm giving you is a sleeping pill, and I'm telling you that, if it's blue, it has a bigger effect than if it's some other color. And it turns out pills that are purple, that's funny. I mean, the purple pill that I'm sure you know about from advertising, ask your doctor for the purple pill. Well, it turns out purple pills have bigger placebo effects than pills that are green or yellow or other. If I give you a pill that's large, it has a bigger placebo effect than if it's a small one. If I inject you with a placebo, that has a bigger effect than if I give it to you in capsule or pill form. So the finding is pills work, capsules work better than pills, injections work best of all. And it turns out the thing that has the most massive effect is sham surgery, where there are experiments that have been done showing that people have been told they're going to have surgery, that they're put under, the doctor makes an incision, sews it back up, says things went really well. And the response there for certain kinds of conditions where they've tested it is pretty massive. And so the findings go. And now these are subject to question and legitimately so. But some of the findings that are emerging are really pretty compelling. One of the most intriguing of these is that if I am the one administering, let's say, a pain medication to you, and I've been duped into believing that what I'm giving you is a true painkiller when, in fact, it's inert, you will respond with pain analgesia because I'm the one administering it who has been led to believe that it's going to work. So it works for both the caregiver as well as the recipient. Now, obviously, these findings don't apply to all forms of illness, and I think it's really important to understand that what's happening with most of these placebo effects is that the it's not very often that you will get anything like what might be called a permanent cure for a condition, but you certainly do find lots of evidence that it will relieve discomfort associated with illness. And so this is what you would find described as the placebo analgesia effect. It's not always long-lasting, but it has been found to be a very enduring finding in this research. So some people hear that, and what they say is, so that just goes to show that it's all in the mind and it's imagined and so on. And there is a sense in which it's all in the mind, but the more recent research that I've been reading suggests that something really, really interesting is going on here. That is starting to unpack how this is all working. Now, to explain that, let me give you a two-sentence summary of several lines of research by molecular biologists. One of them has to do with the discovery that in the brain there are pain receptors, so If I was doing a brain scan on you and I administered pain, the pain receptor areas would light up. If you were in pain and I gave you an opiate that would be there to deaden the pain, what would happen is that there are areas of the brain that basically are receptors for these pain deadeners. They call them sometimes keyholes, or they call them satellites that are kind of primed to be looking for pain relief, and they would light up. Now, so that's one line of research saying something's going on here in the brain, and there are regions of the brain that are being activated in response to pain and to relief from pain. But a second line of research says the brain actually has the capacity to manufacture its own painkillers. These we know now as endorphins, which stands for endogenous morphines. And what that's about is biochemical processes interior to the body, which become activated under conditions people don't always understand, where the mind, where the brain is actually, the body is actually, triggers are sent off, which are manufacturing these endorphins, which are acting in the same way that an externally induced injection of morphine would work. So this has now come together in this really interesting, to me, very interesting line of work. So the way these experiments are done is as follows. If you're a subject, we bring you in and we say, we've been testing let's say it's an ointment that has analgesic properties which we believe will be effective in the treatment of pain on the surface of the skin or whatever it might be. So they hook you up with a brain scan, and they administer heat or shock or something like that. And they then look at what's happening in the brain, and what's happening in the brain is that the areas where the pain receptors are known to be light up. That makes sense. Then I say, okay, now we're going to try this ointment and see if it works, and past tests have indicated that it's really effective, and we rub this on, and they go to great lengths. It's funny to read these because the experimenters are putting on rubber gloves, and they take out these vials of ointment for experimental purposes only, do not ingest, all that kind of thing. And they now take that and they rub it on your arm and say, look, it takes a little while for this thing to operate. And, in fact, it's something like suntan lotion or some such thing. Then they administer the same level of discomfort in heat or shock or whatever it is. And lo and behold, the areas where the pain receptors are go dark, and the areas that are known to be producing the endorphins light up. So what it's saying is that this placebo effect, what's called the placebo effect, in fact, has this kind of physiological basis to it, which is beginning to explain this phenomenon that's been called placebo analgesia. Now, just one other study, and then I'll be done here. It turns out that if you're in pain, I can inject you with morphine, and that will relieve the pain. Okay? But then I can inject you with another drug, which is called naloxone. And if I do that, it will block the action of the morphine. So the pain will return. Well, now it turns out that in studies of placebo, what they've been able to do is basically induce this placebo analgesia where people are reporting that they are getting relief from inert substances. And then they inject them with naloxone, and they say the pain is back. And what that's suggesting is that this is a real thing. It is not an imagined thing. It is something that's going on inside the head. Well, I think you can see why I found that line of research so intriguing. And it sort of leads me to say, you know, when you look at the results that have come out of this body of research that I've been alluding to, it begins to make a lot of sense why, if belief is present and the conviction is deep, an appeal to a strand of hair or a piece of cartilage from the ear or whatever it might be, if the belief system is supporting that, it's plausible to argue that this mechanism of pain analgesia is operating and that people are gaining genuine relief from physical symptoms, and that relief is not permanent, but I'll mention this in a minute. It's not permanent, but it's plausible to argue that this system as it was being practiced worked. And the reason then why I think that people believed in it so greatly is and gave it such legitimacy is precisely because it made available to them a kind of way of dealing with physical distress that would actually prove to be effective. Just one more word, and that is, so I said it's temporary, and so what would happen is if I went to Beckett and I appealed to Beckett and I said, you know, I feel better, and then whatever I had recurred, the explanation was clear. I sinned again. Did the same thing. Whatever I did the first time, I did again. And so there was this ready-made explanation. Well, I think I've said enough to be able to take some questions, so good.
Thanks so much for that great talk. I start. Anybody have a question right away?
Okay, yeah.
Where do you think the mind is?
Where do I think it is? Oh, that's a great question. I've read, there's a wonderful book by a historian of science at Harvard whose name is Ann Harrington, who's written a book about the history of the attempts to try to answer that very question. I'm not qualified to be able to answer it except to thank you for having asked a very provocative question. I'm going to duck, but it's a wonderful question. Yeah,
I think one thing that's interesting about it, just an experience almost everybody has, that you're in a room and you suddenly feel like somebody has just walked into the room. Not this room, obviously, with all the people, but a place where you're alone and you feel that somebody's walked in. And, you know, sometimes it's somebody that you know and you turn around and they're there. Occasionally it's a cat or an animal. But, you know, you still have the same experience. That's happened to plenty of people. And so whatever that mind is or wherever it is, it's an experience that we all have. There's some sense that another mind exists within somewhere within this space.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very, very common experience.
Yeah, yeah.
I just think that what's really important to think in terms of the concept of miracles in this culture, because this culture, everybody thinks you have to be able to rationally objectify everything. Anyone like myself who's had an experience of a miracle, there isn't a chance in hell anybody could talk me out of it. If a person has not, it's like psychic stuff. Anybody who's not had the experience, try talking to them into it, forget it.
Yeah.
And I think, or anyone who's had, I've also had a clinical death experience, or anyone who's gardening. I mean, I'm gardening lately, and you take 10 teeny tiny microscopic seeds, You put them in the same soil, same water, same sun, and they create these different plants. Teeny tiny thing. That's phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the fact that we think that there are, you know, just these a couple little miracle cures over here, the whole thing's a miracle.
Sure.
If we look at our hands, or anyone who's had someone pass over that they're still connected to, I mean, I understand the idea of praying to saints because my mom's on the other side. I can ask her for pretty much anything.
Mm-hmm.
Not my father. He's off somewhere else. But, yeah.
I mean, if you did it,
yeah.
Well,
yeah. Yeah.
But I just think it's so important. Or anybody who's been out on the desert and look up at the stars. I mean, I think atheism is an urban phenomenon.
Oh, I see. Well, just a comment about that so that you'll understand what I'm trying to do, which is not to supplant any other forms of understanding about this, but trying to ask the question of is there anything that is being contributed by the lines of research that I've been looking at that might deepen our understanding of what that's about. So it's not meant to supplant anything, but I appreciate your comment. Yeah.
One side comment here. It seems like at all times in history, there's a wide variety of belief about and a wide variety of non-belief about a large number of things. But what differs from time to time, so that we say this age is one way, this age is how much market share, in a way, does mm-hmm. each idea have? And I think that the Middle Ages at a time, lack of education, everything, was a time of tremendous belief in this.
That's
that
right.
That would be one way to look at it.
There's
still plenty of people today who believe the same, but the market share is definitely down.
But just on that point, George, I mean, I've described this as though what I'm talking about is a phenomenon that's characteristic of the medieval period, and it was. But this practice of pilgrimage, of appealing to saints, and so on, is massively pervasive in the contemporary world. Lourdes, La Salette, Metagorgi, Chimayo in New Mexico, and this is a phenomenally robust thing. So it's not as if this thing all died out with the Reformation. It never did. It never did. It's persisted. Yeah. Yeah.
Even communism hasn't died out.
Yeah.
My name is Dr. George Lundberg, and I want to first thank you for setting up my talk on July 12th.
That's great.
So beautifully. As George announced earlier, it's in the evening on a Monday, and it's how to rein in healthcare costs right now.
Right now.
Second, when I was in medical school a very long time ago, our chief of surgery would often say, here's a patient who needs an operation. It doesn't matter what operation, some operation.
Some operation, yeah. That's. I'll cite that in future talks. Thank you.
It appears that this system would work a lot better on people who are gullible or superstitious. So does it mean that people who are rational or skeptic would be not
No,
be
it turns out there that's a very good question, and it turns out that there are people who are much more responsive to placebo effect than others. But measures like gullibility don't hold up. What does hold up, I don't know. I don't think people have a clear understanding, but there's no set of studies I know of that show that sort of a characteristic type of personality, an hysteric, for example, is no more prone to this placebo impact than others. So it's a very good question as to what is it. What you do know is that on average, in any population, I forget what the percentage is that they cite of people who are what are called placebo responders, but it's pretty high. But when you look at them, it's very hard to find anything that they have in common. Yeah.
I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that we're listening to Robert Scott talk about miracle cures and analysis of them. And we have time for a few more questions.
Good.
Hi. I'm David Dupree. I grew up Southern Baptist mm-hmm. and then switched to Christian Science and then switched into some other things. And I've noticed personally that it's the level, a lot of it has to do with the level of authority I accord somebody or something.
Yeah.
And that my own resistance, especially to those miracle stories in the Bible as a Baptist, while they were really fun and stuff, they sort of cut out at about age 8.
Uh-huh.
Mary Baker Eddy did a lot for me,
yeah,
and the Buddha has done more.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm finding that a lot of it is I'm involved in all three of those things, and it's how much I choose. So my choice has something to do with it, and I can see where doctors in our culture have a major authority figure.
That's right.
And
that's right. And I you know, I hark back to that finding I alluded to on placebos, where the doctor, as the authority figure, has been misled into believing that what they're doing is going to be efficacious. It has as much of an impact as if you do that with the patient. So the authority figure is critical, and certainly in the practice of Christianity in the medieval period, that role of authority was absolutely critical, as it is in places like Lourdes today. Yeah.
And yeah. I think it's a really good comment on the authority, how important that is. And so the belief of the authority improves, but it doesn't, it's not all, because
no.
There are plenty of preachers that go around, don't believe, I mean, they're out to make money, and they also affect
yeah.
cures,
yeah.
they affect all kinds of changes. So it's the belief in authority, and then how much the authority believes,
yeah.
that
yeah.
increases the percentage.
Yeah.
I have two cases, people that I know who have gone to Lourdes and have been cured. One was a young teenage girl who had a brain tumor, had operated on it,
mm-hmm.
and it had fingers, and they could not get it all out, and she was in constant seizures. And she went to Lourdes, told her mother, don't worry, I'm going to be cured. She came back, and there was no sign of a,
wow.
of a tumor. She grew up, she married, and had children. Another man that I know personally was operated on for some abdominal problems, and I don't know exactly what it was. They opened him up. He was full of cancer. Closed him up. Said, we can't do anything about you.
Mm-hmm.
His wife got some Lourdes water, bathed him daily with Lourdes water. He's in his late 80s, and he's doing fine.
Wow.
He's in the medical field.
Wow. Yeah.
His wife is gone. He's doing fine. And those are two people that I know personally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm not really a miracle believer.
Mm-hmm.
But to me,
but it's really, if I could just comment on that, because there are accounts. I've read a lot about Lourdes and about the miracles that have taken place there. And the case studies that you read are very, very compelling. I'd also point out that there, in the whole history of Lourdes, which dates to 1865 maybe is when it was originally established, to today, where there have been hundreds of millions of pilgrims, there are only 66 documented cures. So what happens, and the reason I'm mentioning this, is not to doubt those 66 or even to doubt the cases. I don't doubt that at all. But what happens is that these kinds of cases become exemplars, which are exactly attracting people whose illnesses are not nearly so extreme. A lot of what I'm trying to talk about here, I believe, does get activated among that population of people. But I was surprised when I actually looked at the data and thought, oh my goodness, I thought this was, you know, that you would have tens of thousands of cases, and it's not so. Yeah,
and even the authority. Here, the church is the one that decides what's the documented case. In
that's
way.
Exactly right. Yeah, and so that's
true. And they're very conservative, but they're
yeah.
also extremely conservative. They
yeah.
don't pick that many cases.
Yeah.
One other comment, since we do Monday Night Philosophy and we're talking about rationality and everything all the time, I think it's really important when you are trying to come up with what the real patterns are in human life, with what really is happening in human life, that you don't take facts like this and just say they don't exist. This is not being rational.
No, that's exactly
believing in something else. But there are rational explanations, and you know, one of them has to do with the mind. What does the mind do? But it just plays a part.
Yep.
But it doesn't mean any one idea or another is the reason for it, because this is, you know, true. This kind of thinking, changing things, has
yep.
been true in societies, all kinds of societies across the world.
Yeah.
So we've come to the part where there's only time for one more question. Who'd like to ask the last question?
Yeah.
Would you like to ask the last question? You just no.
Yeah.
You can stay afterwards and ask questions.
Okay, sure.
My question is, have there been any studies with regard to hypnosis and medical cures, since we're talking about the overcoming of the mind and beliefs.
Good question. Pass. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if there have been, but that's a very interesting question because, and worth looking into it to see what is happening with hypnosis, whether it's producing any of these effects and how that's understood by proponents of it. But I can't answer that.
I'm going to add one more question. It was a short one, but it's an interesting part of the whole issue about authority, because you're letting somebody else take control. So in hypnosis, you want somebody else to do something for you that you're not going to do yourself in a way. So you really have to believe in authority. It's an interesting part of our society.
Yeah.
Our society is not really hot on authority.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so if we're not hot on authority, this should be rarer and rarer. Market share going down. So one last question.
Right? Yeah.
I was wondering, since during this period pregnancy had a high mortality rate, mm-hmm. I would think that they would have also encouraged women that appeared to be pregnant and the concern about losing the child or losing that woman, putting them on a pilgrimage. I was wondering if you had any indications of that.
Wow.
And when the community as a whole wants somebody to go on a pilgrimage because they're not well, do they contribute the money?
Absolutely, they do. Let me deal with that latter question first. They absolutely do, because what they are saying is you are jeopardizing the collective. We are going to provide you with the means to basically neutralize that danger. And so they help to underwrite the cost of it. Your question about pregnancy is a really interesting one, because I cannot think. I've looked through the shrine records, principally at Canterbury, but also at Lincoln and at Westminster Abbey and so on, where they've recorded them. I can't think of a single case that I ever came across where they talked about women who were pregnant going on pilgrimage in hopes of getting a cure that would allow them and their child to survive. But that's a really interesting question. But I can't think of any case.
Also, I love their question about the underwriting the exile, because our communities don't use that, but I'm sure that it could become popular again if everyone realized that by paying someone to leave, you could get rid of someone.
That's right.
Community.
Exactly, yeah. Good.
So thanks again, Dr. Scott, for that wonderful presentation.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. Good.
We also thank our audience here at the club, as well as those listening on the radio and online. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
There you go.